I suggest that it's important for me to have one of those written down at all times, so I know who I am and what I'm trying to be. You know, one of the men that helped me told me, Mike, he says, you may make a promise to yourself or a request like that, and he says you may not be able to keep it, but it's for sure if you never make the promise, you won't keep it. If you don't set an ideal for yourself, how in the world is God going to help you live up to it? You know. And but this is the reason I mention this now and not in four step is this is where I get to understand how really powerless I am. This is the best I can do for the person I love most in the world. This is the absolute top of my game, best I can do. And look what I did. And you know something? I know today I'm not a badass. If I could have done any better, I would have. And that doesn't mean it was okay for me to do that. But what this takes me to, it takes me how much into my powerlessness in that I must absolutely have God's help. Because I can tell you to the tip of my toes, if I could have acted any differently there, I would have. And I believe most of us are that way. All of us that aren't sociopaths or psychopaths. I mean, that behavior is the behavior of a sociopath or a psychopath, somebody who either doesn't care or doesn't is indifferent to the wrong they do or just doesn't care. And the fact is, what kills me is that I do care and I do it anyway. And if I'm going to live that way, sooner or later, there's going to be a drink behind it. I'm going to need some pills behind it. I'm going to need something. So I need to acknowledge this. All these we'll talk about these in terms of steps 1 and 2 and 3 and 4 and so forth. But you know, I got to understand here what I have here is an approach to life that is linear. If I have a problem at the office come Monday, you know, there's not going to be any solution to that problem possible until I understand that I'm powerless over whatever's going on here. And I'm willing to acknowledge that what I'm trying to do to change it isn't working. You know, because until I make that acknowledgement, God can't help me. Why can God? I don't need God's help. I just need these people to act right. You know, I need to just Listen, I'm going to explain it to you one more time. You're doing it wrong, you know. And they dig their heels in and resist me more and all that kind of stuff, and it ain't working. So now I'm living in the solution because I can't fix it and I can't change it. Then it's very simple. Am I willing to consider the possibility that I might be able to get spiritual help with this problem? If I say yes, my second step's in place. I'm willing to ask for spiritual help. Third step in place. You know, am I willing to examine what's really going on here? I pick up the pencil and I start writing. You know, I get ready where I get to a point where I'm really, really ready to say to God, you know, if you'd take this mess I've made, I'd let you do it. Now, sometimes, you know, I don't need to take weeks or months or write a book in order to do that. I do this hundreds of times a week, and every time I'm smart enough to realize that I've hit a speed bump in life, you know. But it's all the same process. It's not a once-a-year process. It's not a once-a-month process or when I'm working with others process. It's a way of life. And so whether I know it or not, I'm constantly and continuously applying these principles in my life. Last new guy I worked with here, one of the things when we do first step, I have a little... In addition to, first of all, the foundation and reading everything in this book, and we can't do that here, I do with him a little first step reflection here. And I'll just share that with you here. The question is, contemplate and reflect upon and write about your relationship with alcohol. For example, when you first been drinking, what was your experience? For example, what was it fun? Did it give you confidence? My answer is it was a miracle drug, and it restored me to sanity. I was insane without alcohol. How did your relationship with alcohol change over time? For example, did it demand more from you than you were getting from it? I craved its effect from the very start. It allowed me to feel what normal should feel like. See, it looked like to a lot of people that I was drinking to party. And sometimes I did, but mostly I was drinking to feel what I thought normal should feel like. I just wanted to feel comfortable, like I fit inside my own skin. And that's why sobriety had been unacceptable to me all those years. I'd get sober and stay sober 30, 60, 90 days, but eventually came the point that I couldn't stand the way I felt in my own skin. And one of the men that opened my eyes, he says, "Well, Mike, don't you understand sobriety is the main cause of drinking?" You know? And that's exactly, you know, one of those V8 moments here. Yeah. So it allowed me to feel normal should feel like. It allowed me to face life. It was part of the fabric of my life. I celebrated it. I worshiped it. I never even considered doing it without it. What was your relationship with alcohol at the time of your last drink? Was it your friend, your lover, your enemy? It was a disappointingly unfaithful lover. You know? Now even my best moments with me were a mocking reminder of the glorious past. Reflect on your hopelessness and helplessness in relation to alcohol. Life was impossible without it and impossible with it. I'd casually trade away all my dreams and self-respect. And then I got into, here's my piece of this. What's today? What's the most troubling circumstance in your life right now? Well, my lack of consistency. At this time, I had to do some professional education to continue several of my professional licenses. So my lack of consistent progress on my CE studies. Are you willing to go to any length to resolve this? Yes. Where am I being dishonest with others? I won't set aside to get the work and studying done. I claim that I'm too busy. You know, where am I being dishonest with myself? I pretend I have all the time in the world to get this done, but I do, in fact, have a deadline to meet. You know, what do powerlessness and unmanageability with respect to this problem really mean to me, and how are they different? You know, I'm powerless to do this my way and on my terms. One more time, I must surrender to the fact that I'm not special, and that all of the rules do apply to me. I'm casually feeding a little bit of my peace of mind each day into the beast of procrastination. Powerlessness is the fact of my condition. Unmanageable means that I cannot successfully solve this with my will. So that's one of the reasons. I need to know that powerless and unmanageable did not end on September 7th of 1985. I need to have a current relationship with this stuff. By the way, I like it when these things get a little interactive. So if I say something that you have a question about, or you want to add something to, please feel free to do this. Well, that's one of the reasons I like smaller groups, because we can get more interchange going, because we've got enough people here that we probably need to raise a hand and do this in an orderly fashion. But definitely want to hear from you, and any questions or anything like that that you have would be a valuable contribution to what we're doing here. So, it says here, I had to learn that I had to fully concede to my innermost self that I was an alcoholic. Have I done that? This is the first step in recovery. The delusion that I am like other people or presently maybe has to be smashed. You know. And that peace set me free. And it set me free because I lived my life as an actor. I got up every day and I decided what role I was going to play that day. And I put on my costume. And it was I the businessman today? Was I the boyfriend today? Was I the nice guy today? Was I the jerk today? Whatever. But I was always kind of one step separated from myself. I was playing a role, and I was mostly playing a role in order to fit into what I perceived to be your world. And I wanted to be like other people, and I found out they set me free here, that I'm not like other people, and I'm not going to be anytime soon, so I can drop that burden. I still have to live by your rules, go on the green, stop on the red, and all that kind of stuff. But I was able to be free of trying to be like other people. And that was important for me. I'd read this book for a lot of times during the first few years I was sober, I'd pick up a quote here. If you're a junior guru, you need a snappy quote or so to throw into stuff. But it didn't really attach to me in any kind of personal way. And one of the things that Gary did in that first workshop with me is he taught me to start reading this stuff in the first person so I knew that it applied to me. And he started me looking for the places where the book makes a statement, I need to take that statement and turn it into a question for myself. And so when it talks about blackouts occurring only with alcoholics and never in the normal temperate drinker, I got to ask myself, well, have I ever experienced blackouts? You know? I go through all of this stuff here. It talks in those terms, and then the book makes statements about what happened to these people when they followed this course of action that's laid out in here, and that those are promises, and the entire book's just shot through them, starting at the title page with the primary promise. We're more than 100 men and women who've recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. To show other people how we recovered is... And one of the things that Bill does here in writing this book is that one of the great places to find a summation, if you will, a Cliff Notes thing, is at the beginning of each chapter. Bill seems to kind of wrap up what's gone on before here. So at the beginning of chapter 4 here, we've covered the doctor's opinion in the first 3 chapters here. Are essentially talking about our first step here. And so it says here in the beginning of chapter 4, in the preceding chapters, you've learned something of alcoholism. Well, do I understand what alcoholism is at this point? Do I understand it's not about me being more thirsty than somebody else? Do I understand that alcoholism is what happens to me when I quit drinking? Yeah. That alcoholism doesn't come in bottles, it comes in people. You know? And that it's who I am when I'm not drinking, when I'm stone cold sober, that takes me back into the drink. You know? The craziest thing I do is stone cold sober, no matter what my previous experience, no matter that I don't want to hurt this woman, no matter that I promised my employer that I'd never do that again, and he promised me that if I did, I would lose my job, no matter what, I'm going to take a drink again. And that I do from a place of being stone cold sober. I mean, they told me I never had to worry about the craving for alcohol again if I never took the first drink. But there's an idiot that lives inside me that's stone cold sober will whisper in my ear and tell me that a drink is a good idea. Now, if you talked to me the way my own mind would talk to me, you know, we'd have trouble. There's one of my old ideas is that these internal voices are somehow more credible than the external voice that I hear. Well, it came from inside, so it must be true, you know. That's where a lot of my looniness, you know. It turns out that, you know, I've got to treat my own mind at times like a wet drunk, you know. We get a wet drunk in our meeting, and you can't shut them up. But you never follow their advice, do you? So, I mean, there's a big piece of my mind that I'm going, well, thank you for sharing that, and move on. So in the preceding chapters, I've hopefully learned something of alcoholism. We hope we made the distinction between the alcoholic and the non-alcoholic clear. Do I know what the distinction is between an alcoholic and a non-alcoholic? Checklist. And then they lay it out here. If when you honestly want to, you find you can't quit entirely, that's like completely, or if when drinking you have little control over the amount you take, you're probably alcoholic. If that be the case, you may be suffering from an illness which only a spiritual experience will conquer. Do I believe that I'm suffering from an illness that only a spiritual experience will conquer? That's because if I don't believe that, I better go back and I better start looking at that first step again. I don't have a first step here. To be doomed to an alcoholic death or live on a spiritual basis are not always easy alternatives to face. Now, I submit to you that if we go out on the street tomorrow, or maybe Sunday when the people are walking out of church and ask them whether they'd prefer to live life on a spiritual basis or die an alcoholic death, that you wouldn't have a very large percentage opting for alcoholic death. Only an alcoholic is going to think alcoholic, well, that could be an option. Yeah. I was working with one young guy some time ago, and we got to this point, and he says, well, so how bad is an alcoholic death, you know? Yeah. So, lack of power is my dilemma. I had to find a power by which I could live, and obviously it had to be a power greater than myself. And it tells me this is exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable me to find a power greater than myself, which will solve my problem. Now that's problem, not problems. I thought I had problems. And Don said, you do, but there's one problem that causes all the other problems. And that's me. I came to the spiritual life with a lot of prejudice. And one of the things that we talk about here in this is constantly they're begging me to lay aside my prejudice. Not get rid of it, just lay it aside. I can return to my prejudice later if I'm missing it. But it sounds, they make me a promise here. We found as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves, we commenced to get results, even though it was impossible for any of us to fully define or comprehend the power which is God. I don't have to have a sophisticated ecclesiastical understanding of spiritual matters. I don't need to be able to tell you about how many angels are dancing on the head of the pin or when the people left Galilee or any of that kind of stuff. If I have that information, that's okay. But I don't need to have all of that information or a sophisticated understanding to begin to have this relationship with God. Much to our relief, we discovered we did not need to consider another's conception of God. Our own conception, however inadequate, was sufficient to make the approach and to effect contact with Him. And how about another beautiful promise here? We found that God does not make too hard terms with those who seek Him. To us, the realm of the Spirit is broad, roomy, all-inclusive, never exclusive or forbidding to those who earnestly seek. And then it tells me to ask me to look at the prejudice I have against spiritual terms. And it was done with me, and I do it with my guys. I ask them to go through this chapter and find all the spiritual terms and write out for yourself what they mean to you. And the spiritual terms are generally the terms in capital letters in there. And any other spiritual terms. I know for me, one of the things that just would set me off is anybody that would say the Lord would just send me up. It was like chalk on a blackboard. I just, my mind snapped shut and I couldn't hear another word that was said there. And so I needed to look at why I had prejudice against that word, so I couldn't even hear it. The minute I heard it, I reacted to it. Because if I don't understand what's going on here, I can't let God change that. I can't give away what I'm not aware of that I've got. I found out that I had God defined in such a way that God either couldn't or wouldn't help me. And it's interesting, here I got the benefit of my functional family. When I was doing some of this work, I went back and I gave my sister a call. And I said, Carol, I said, you remember that crazy Holy Roller outfit that they used to put us on the bus and send us to and everything else? And she said, well, what do you mean? And I gave her some more descriptions. She says, oh, that church. And I said, yeah, you remember that they scared the hell out of us and everything. Told us we were going to burn in hell and all this kind of stuff. And she said, really? She says, I just remember them saying Jesus loved us. Yeah. See, my old ideas. You know, my sister sat right beside me. I heard I was going to burn in hell, and she heard that Jesus loved her. You know. And there are profound consequences for carrying that old kind of misinformation. I don't know, maybe I was right, maybe she was right, but I tell you what, the world looks a lot better if she's right. You know. I've come to find out being right's highly overrated here, you know. Yeah. And one of the things, go ahead.
Barry. One of the things when I encountered that when I was there, and I actually ended up changing part of the first step, and I thought that I didn't understand. Because the one that I understood was the thing about my own concepts and such. And so I said, okay, I'm going to make it sound like I don't understand. And it worked fine for me. Because what I did see was that there were people in fellowship that faced a certain day of time. And they obviously had an answer that I didn't have. And so if I just followed along and tried to work
Thanks. Yeah. I find that for me it's more important that I have a conception rather than a concept. When I've got a concept, you can't change it. When I have a conception, I don't hold it lightly, but it can be changed. And I'm involving in what I've had to do over the period of time. And my friend Clint pointed out to me that we were talking about something else, but he said, you know, I was talking about relationship with him, and he says, Mike, he says, you don't have a relationship, you've got an arrangement. And I came to realize that most of what in life I'd been referring to as relationships were arrangements. An arrangement means if you do this for me, I'll do this for you. It's a contractual thing. A relationship is a sort of covenant, you know. I am materially interested in your well-being, and I'm gonna act that way in support of that. No wonder this stuff didn't work that I was calling relationships, because they were really arrangements. And what I really came to see is that what I'd been trying to do is I was trying to negotiate an arrangement with God, and I called it a relationship. You do this for me, I'll do this for you. God, I'll go do 12-step work if you keep me sober. God, I'll do this if you do that. And that's completely the way my eyes got open to that. He said, well, you know, do you believe in God? Yeah, I believe in God. Do you have a relationship with God? Well, you know, he says, well, belief in God is a good place to start, but it won't get the job done. It's kind of like that cheerleader you were hot for in high school, you know. Just believing in Mary won't get the job. I mean, how satisfying is just believing in Mary? Don't you need a little something else going on with Mary? And that's true. In order to have a real effective relationship here. So belief is the place to start. And when I write inventory today, it keeps coming back to that, because when I write a piece of inventory, resentment, fear, whatever, conduct, I get to look after I've written that piece of inventory, I get to see, well, if somebody I sponsored brought me this piece of inventory, what would their relationship with God be? What would it look like? You know? Well, God's waiting to get me. God doesn't care about my happiness. God just wants me to be good. God doesn't... All the same. That's based... Based on the way I wrote about that resentment or that fear. And then I get to ask myself, I get to turn in the next direction, and I say, well, is that what I really believe? Heck no. You know. One of the first times that ever happened for me, I wrote... a bunch of inventory on stuff. It doesn't really matter. We'll maybe get to it later on in the fourth step. But in the fourth column in the inventory under my mistakes, one of the things, there were different stuff in all of them, but one that was in all of them was unable or unwilling to trust God. Unwilling or unable to trust God. And I read that inventory to Don, and I'd been doing this for fair amount of time at this time, and Don picked that out. He says, Mike, you know, with all this stuff, you just keep coming back, this unable and unwilling to trust God. He says, I've known you for a while, and he says, I believe you're a man who would very much like to trust God. He says, now, if you're not trusting God, there must be something that's blocking you. Let's take a look at that. And what I came up with was that I'm my conception of God at that time was centered around God the Father. My father, I idolized him. He was dead at the time, but I mean, I didn't see this as being a problem, because I, you know, I didn't have any dad stuff going at the time. And then as I thought about it and prayed about it, where I got taken back to was in our kitchen. Not long after I'd come back from Vietnam, I'm sitting at the kitchen table with my dad. My dad's this big guy sitting there with tears in his eyes and a pile of my bad checks in front of him that he'd gone around that small town and bought back from his fellow businessman friends. And my dad's looking at me the most powerful guy in my life, and he isn't full of anger. He's got tears, and he says, "Son, I would do anything in the world to help you, but it seems like every time I try and help you, you keep screwing up. What am I going to do with you?" And somehow I translated that, and I heard God saying to me, "Mike, look at all I've done for you. I've saved your life in Vietnam. I've given you relationships. I've given you careers. I've given you money. Look at all I've given you, and you keep screwing it up." Now, that was perfectly appropriate for my Cuban father to tell me. But as long as I hung on to that little piece of belief, then I placed myself in a place where God couldn't or wouldn't help me. And until I realized that piece of an old idea that didn't seem all that hard for me. I mean, God the Father sounded like a pretty good idea for me. And maybe for you. I'm not suggesting anybody else needs to change. But for me, it was now the thing that was keeping me from having the relationship that I needed to have with power greater than myself. And so I got to change my mind. I could keep that old vision if I wanted to, but there was a new vision available to me if I would have it. Maybe I don't have it with me. Okay. Well, I don't have it. I came where I have a relationship with God with four basic corners, four pillars, if you will, to it today. And the first pillar is just this. God doesn't think comparatively. God loved me just as much when I was writing a bad check in a liquor store to buy a bottle of booze to go seduce my neighbor's wife as he does when I'm helping a newcomer down at the Salvation Army. Now, the consequences for me are different in those two different places. But God, I can't be God's favorite kid, and I can't be the bad kid in class either. God just, comparative thought is a human characteristic. Not a divine characteristic. So God will love me wildly and completely no matter where I am. And that's the second one. So God doesn't think comparatively. God loves me wildly and completely. And then one of the things that really had a profound effect on my life was that some years ago, a man suggested to me, he said, "Mike, I'd like you to consider what your life would be like if you took the position and lived life on the basis that God wants your happiness more than you do yourself. What does that think?" See, I assumed that God wanted me to be good, God wanted me to be useful, God wanted to be... But what would my life... I always was kind of trying to figure out how to negotiate the best deal with God, how I could give him the least and get the most. You know, I'm trying to horse trade here. I'm afraid I'm going to overpay God here. And what's my life like? How does that relationship change if I'm all of a sudden look at life from instead of God just wanting me to be good, God really wants me to be happy. That's the number one thing. And the man said, you know, happened to be a priest that belongs to my home group. And Father Larry said, you know, most of the people from this parish, and I'm talking about non-alcoholics here, but that come in to see me, when I ask them what they want for their children, they don't tell me they want them to be doctors or lawyers or anything else. They tell me, "Oh, Father, we just want our kids to be happy." He says, you know, if that's what human beings do you want for their kids, can't you imagine that God would want that for you? And so I It revolutionized. All of a sudden now, instead of God, somebody that I'm trying to keep at arm's length and deal with, you know, I'm treating God like the IRS. You know, I got to deal with him, but I don't want to have any more contact than is absolutely necessary. And now, I can hang out with God. Now it's not torture to meditate. I can start to realize what it says in our book. It says, it talks about God, and the image we get is God is our newfound friend. A newfound friend. Wow, what a beautiful thing here. I've got a newfound friend. And you know, the benefits that, you know, it's like working for a company in the world that's got the world's best benefit package, you know? If I work for that, there's nobody that's got a benefit package like the God of my understanding. I get all of my needs taken care of, and quite a few of my wants. And then the fourth thing, it was said, is, Mike, would you consider that God might know what would make you happy even more than you do yourself? And yeah, because here I'm sitting here with a handful of inventory, and basically it had stuff in it, but what the inventory really represented was a lifetime of me trying to make me happy. That's what at the bottom line about this was. This inventory that I'm sitting here, this thing that had put a chill on my heart, was what it looked like me doing the very best I could at that point for 40 some years to make me happy. How good a job have I done? You know, would I hire a guy like me as a subcontractor? I wouldn't do it. So yeah. And the other thing he pointed out to me, you know, he says, by the way, Mike, you need to understand that there's a difference between happiness and pleasure. And you confuse them all the time. Happiness is real. Happiness is like good, healthy, nourishing food. It builds you up. It never tears you down. The pleasure, it's like junk food. You know, you can get on a sugar buzz and, you know, I can speed eat a pint of Häagen-Dazs. But a little later, I'm going to feel like hell as a result of that. It's got a blowback from it. And happiness doesn't have that. So I got the four little pieces here, and it's because there are a lot of people that are way more spiritually sophisticated, but I need some simple anchor points as a starting point to start developing that relationship with God. Those little anchor points that when I'm scared to death I'm afraid, you know, because I got the call from the doctor or my mom just died, and or whatever has happened, that I can go back to the, wait a minute. I'm scared to death here, but I'm not seeing the whole picture. There's some pieces of this that I'm not seeing yet. Because God's like the Calvary, just waiting over the hill to come swoop in and help me. I don't see the whole picture here. And so if I'll just turn back here, instead of, you know, Don used to say, when in trouble, when in doubt, run in circles, scream and shout. You know, if I won't do that, if I'm willing to start relaxing into my relationship with Him, then I've got there's a chance for my power, His power to help me. When I'm all tensed up like this, I can't be helped. I can't be helped physically. And when I'm like this spiritually, I need to just start breathing and relaxing. And now, okay, my mind can slow down. I can start getting off the squirrel cage and getting to a place where that relationship with God, while it always exists for Him, where I become conscious of it again. I got a friend that tells a story I love, and Pete says, you know, okay, Mike, he says, do you know the difference between having a belief and having faith? I says, well, I think I do, Pete, but tell me what your definition is. He says, well, He says, if we stretched a rope across the Grand Canyon, do you believe that God could walk across that rope? Well, I said, of course he could. He says, well, do you believe that God could walk across that rope and push a wheelbarrow? Well, yeah. He says, get in the wheelbarrow. Getting in the wheelbarrow is having the faith, you know, where I'm now willing to get in the wheelbarrow and let God be the center and the solution in my life. Frank's got some dessert waiting for us. So I know better than to get in between alcoholics and ice cream. But it's one of the most dangerous places in the world to be. But between the ice cream and one thing another in tomorrow morning, I'd ask you to perhaps consider what your life would look like if you took the position that God wants your happiness more than anything else in the world. That's the number one thing that he's going to get up tomorrow with, saying, you know, I want these folks to be the happiest folks in the world. Nothing would please me more than to see them happy. It would make my heart dance and sing. So, good night. We'll see you in the morning. Yeah. Well, did everybody have a good night's sleep? I'll tell you what, I am really impressed with those showers. That is something else. I mean, as impressive as that river is, that shower is something else. I've never had as much shower as I wanted, you know. Now I've had that obsession satisfied. That's quite a deal here. Well, I'd like to get started this morning with a little bit of a guided meditation. So if you want to get comfortable, let everybody get settled here. We discovered some years ago in my home group that we just all act better, it seems, when we meditate for a couple minutes before we start our meeting. It's amazing how that changes the quality of things for us. Let's start the way we start life, with a deep breath in. As we breathe, let's imagine. Imagine that you are not your personality, your compassion for others. Let it go. Your judgment of others. Let it go. Your ability to make others laugh. Let it go. Your ability to make others cry. Release it and let it go. Everything that makes up your personality, with each breath in and each breath out, let it go. You're not your personality. Imagine that you are not your mind that decides what is right and what is wrong. Let it go. Your mind that makes decisions about what to do and what not to do. Let it go. Your mind that believes it knows what is good and what is bad. Let it go. every thought, idea, and opinion. Let them go. You are not your mind. Imagine that you're not your body. You're not your feet. Let them go. You're not your hands. Let them go. With each breath in and each breath out, let them go. Breathe. Imagine that you are not your disease. It is in you, but it is not you. Let it go. Breathe. You are not your personality. You are not your mind. You are not your body. Do you understand what you are? You are God's creation. You are eternal. Breathe. Amen. I mentioned my family last night, and I brought this picture of my second birthday party here along, and I thought I'd let you pass this around so you could see up close and personal the people that ruined my life and caused all this trouble for me. I'll do anything for sympathy. You can tell right away they're evil. So we were in second step, and one of the important things about this that was pointed out to me is the title of our chapter about the second step, chapter 4, is not we atheists, it's we agnostics. You know, atheists at least have the courage of their conviction. They're certain, by God, God doesn't exist. There is no such thing. Now, agnostics, we're a more limp-wristed bunch, you know. Well, maybe he is, maybe he isn't, could be, maybe not, maybe for you, not for me, whatever. Agnostics are doubters. And it's important for me to be aware for so long, I assumed that the second step was something that I checked off my list a long time ago. I believe in God, and I'm over and done with the second step. And what I find out is all the problems I'm encountering, all have a common component to them. That my agnosticism has reemerged. I've got to look at my current agnosticism. Where right now today, March 4th, 2006, do I doubt the power of God? I can tell you a good indication that I'm doubting the power of God is that I'm lying. If I'm lying, I'm doubting that God will take care of me if I tell the truth. If I'm in anger, if I'm busy being dishonest, all those things are indications that of my current agnosticism, and it's important for me to understand that I have to have a relationship with this step in the here and now, just not just in the past when I first approached this. So I'll suggest that to you. Now, in the second step, it boils down to one question. Do I now believe, or am I even willing to believe, that there's a power greater than myself? Yes or no? If I can answer yes, then I've met the requirements for this step. Now, they go on and they tell me quite a few things after this. And one of them are we get to this place here where they talk about the bedevilments on page 52. And I was under the impression, I read this the first time, it's for you with books, it's about in the middle of the page, and it says here, we are having trouble with personal relationships. We couldn't control our emotional natures. We were a prey to misery and depression. We couldn't make a living. We had a feeling of uselessness. We were full of fear. We were unhappy, and we couldn't seem to be a real help to other people. Now, that sounded to me like a drinking alcoholic. And they said, no, no. What that is that's a description of a sober alcoholic without a spiritual experience. That untreated piece of me is one of the reasons why I will take a drink again absent a spiritual awakening or a spiritual experience. And I had it changed it when I got the pronouns personal here. I was having trouble with personal relationships. You doggone right I was. You know, I can't control my emotional nature. I'm a prey to misery and depression. I can't make. I'm making a living, but not the one I think I need. I'm unhappy, and I don't seem to be a real help with. I'm not effective at the business of life. Every time we sit down in workshop together, find guys, we're sitting around a long time sober, that we can all identify with pieces of that. Somehow some of that has crept back into our lives, and we're not living as effectively as others. We're kind of like a boat that sat in the harbor and picked up some barnacles, and so we don't move quite as smoothly through the water as we used to here. So this is where we are. Interestingly enough, those bedevilments, when we get there, match up almost exactly with the promises in the ninth step. We had everything that I just read you, and by the time we get to the ninth step, we look at the bookends here. Okay. I'm going to know a new freedom and a new happiness. I was unhappy before. I will not regress the past nor wish to shut the door on it. I will comprehend the word serenity and I will know peace. Now, no matter how far down the scale I've gone, I will see that my experience can benefit others. That feeling of uselessness and self-pity will disappear. I will lose interest in selfish things and I'll gain interest in my fellows. Self-seeking will slip away. My whole attitude and outlook upon life will change. Fear of people and of economic insecurity will have left me. I will intuitively know how to handle situations which used to baffle me. I will suddenly have realized that God is doing for me what I could not have ever done for myself. And the fact was, life baffled me. You know, I was smart about some things, but I could never seem to put the whole deal together and get it on the road and get it to stay there for any period of time. So, where are we here? Are we willing to say that we believe, or are we willing to believe that there's a power greater than ourselves? Okay. Now, we can move on. Yeah. insanity? Well, the definition of insanity that I was given was lack of proportion of the ability to think straight. So I react out of proportion to life, and my thinking is skewed. And so for me, sanity would be the ability to do some straight thinking and react in proportion to life. You know, you look at somebody out here's got a little indigestion from breakfast, but I'm sure because the expression on their face that they're upset with me for some reason. You know, that's me reacting out of proportion. You know. Love of my life says, "Good morning, honey," and I said, "Well, what do you mean by that? What do you want?"
I've got that. Well, this will bring us along to chapter 5 here, and I'm somebody who's not only been afflicted with alcoholic thinking, but I've been afflicted with alcoholic listening too. And so I was, you know, one of that first part of chapter 5 is such a beautiful deal, but I think we kind of almost do it a disservice. We read it so much that it just becomes like part of the wallpaper and kind of the background noise, and so it gets read in meetings, and so often at least I'm guilty of sitting there making my shopping list, trying to figure out what I'm going to do first thing tomorrow or yet this evening before I go to bed. And I come back into consciousness about the time we're through with that. And so one night I'm sitting in my home group, and I actually listen to how it works. And I thought to myself, you know, my ideas were so bent for a lot of time, even after I got here, like I was talking about last night. I said, what did I think they were reading when I heard that read? So I went home and got on the computer, and I wrote how I thought it worked here. And I'll share that with you here. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has completed their aftercare. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not learn our numerous slogans and go to 90 meetings in 90 days. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of forming meaningful relationships in treatment facilities. There are such unfortunates. They're not at fault. Their therapist told them so. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a relationship with the vulnerable newcomer. Their chances are less than average. There are those too who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to form meaningful relationships. Our stories disclose in a general way how we were harmed, what happened to those who harmed us, and how we got even in the end. If you've decided you want what we have, you obviously haven't been paying attention to our stories. If you're still determined to get what we have and willing to exert minimal effort to get it, then you're ready for a temporary sponsor. At the first suggestion we balked, we were sure that our sponsors didn't understand. We were determined to find a sponsor who would see things our way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to take it easy on these old fools. Some of us have tried to re-educate our sponsors, and the result was nil until we let go of them absolutely. Remember that we are dealing with our ego, cunning, baffling, and powerful. Without constant praise and reassurance, it's too much for us. But there is one, or possibly more, who has all power. That one is our significant other. May we find them now. Half measures availed us nothing. It was time to move in together. Having abandoned common sense completely, we asked his or her protection and care with great expectations. Here are the steps we took, which interpreted properly
offer a spiritual path to staying sober and having your own way in a meaningful relationship. One, don't drink or get loaded. Try to ignore the fact that you've never actually been able to do this. Two, came to believe that the right relationship could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of our significant other, assuming they had what we needed. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of our significant other. Five, complained to God, ourselves, and our temporary sponsors about the exact nature of their wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove these defective characters. Seven, humbly demanded that he find us the right significant other. Eight, made a list of everyone we found attractive and became willing to have significant relationships with them all. Nine, made direct amends to people who we believe might still be willing to help us restore our net worth, except when we found their significant other attractive. 10, continued to find fault with others, and when they were wrong, promptly pointed it out. 11, sought through prayer and manipulation to improve the behavior of our significant other, praying for all the knowledge of all of their hot buttons and the power to push them at just the right time. And 12, having gotten our own way as the result of these steps, we tried to convince our significant other that this was really for their own good and that their future happiness lay in doing our will. Many of us exclaimed, what an order. They won't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to do this with just one partner. Fortunately, the treatment centers, meetings, and social activities are full of prospects who are not saints. The point is that we are willing to keep replacing partners until we find one or more who will do it our way. The principles we have laid down have proved themselves in coffee shops, clubhouses, and meetings across the land. We claim personal development rather than personal perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the wives, and our personal difficulties before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we were alcoholic and it wasn't our fault. B, that our current therapist and significant other could not relieve our alcoholism. And see that the right partner could and would if they were sought. And if you looked at the way I behaved for 5 years around here, watched me walk around, somebody just watched me walk around AA and wrote down based on my actions what I must be thinking, that unfortunately came pretty close to it. And that's one of the reasons why writing things down, not just in that vein but other veins, I get to see the thinking that's hidden from myself when I'm just letting it process through my mind. When I actually can see in black and white in my own handwriting what in the world is going on between my ears, that's when I start getting the touch. Man, like, that's crazy. You know, how would I ever think that, based on my behavior, that any of this was going to work? But it seemed logical at the time. You know, I was a big fan pre-step work of the third step, and I was a big fan for the reason, a very alcoholic reason, is that I seemed to get a lot of bang for my buck without doing very much. You know, I could say a prayer and offload all my problems to God. What I was in essence was a spiritual litter bug. I'm like a guy that's riding down the highway of life, flipping hamburger wrappers out the window, and here's my problem, take it. Here's this problem, take it. Here's this problem, take it. It's yours, God, and. I'm just going on. Well, the joke was on me because all that trash I kept throwing out just kept blowing back into the back seat. And I eventually
end up with my back seat full of crap and I can't handle it anymore. $2 bill, Jim. Yeah. They took me to right after How It Works here. And they had me approach this again in a first-person perspective. And the light started to come on of why my life wasn't working. So, it says here, being convinced that I'm at step three, which means I'm convinced that I'm an alcoholic and can't manage my life, that no human power is going to relieve my alcoholism, and that God can and will if I seek Him. Just what do we mean by this, and just what do I do? It says the first requirement, which is a lot like must, by the way, the first requirement is that I be convinced that my life run on self-will can hardly be a success. Do I believe that I can do it my way and somehow have it work out? If I believe that, I can just stop right here and go do it my way and have it work out. Yeah. So I need to pause and ask myself that question. On that basis, I'm almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. One of my number one old ideas that still comes up and causes me problems is that I know that you've got some rules and the way things are supposed to be done, but if I've got good intentions, I don't have to play by the rules. You know, I understand. Don't you understand? I've got a good reason for cutting in line here. Don't you know I've got a good reason for driving 80 miles an hour in a 55-mile-an-hour zone? I've got a good reason for doing all these things. And what's that do? That puts me in collision with something or somebody, even though my motives are good. Put me in collision with my business partner. I went and brought in a bunch of really high-class vendors and added them to our business. But I didn't talk to him about it. I just assumed he'd be delighted. And he pointed out to me that his name was ahead of mine on the letterhead and on the door, you know. But I didn't do this. I had good motives. I wanted us to make more money and be more successful and serve our clients better. But I broke the rules, you know, that anything that's going to affect our business, I need to run by him and we need to agree on it. And then I get injured. Well, how just ungrateful SOB. How could he be so ungrateful that I did this for us? You know? Yeah. Like most people, I'm trying to live by self-propulsion, self-will. I'm like an actor who wants to run the whole show. I'm forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, my business partner, the scenery, my girlfriend, in my own way. If only my arrangements would stay put. If only she would do it my way, as I wished. The show would be great. The relationship would be great. The marriage would be great. The business partnership would be great. Just be reasonable. Do it my way. Yeah. Life would be wonderful. Now, when I tried to make these arrangements, I can sometimes be quite virtuous. I can be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, if I was having a bad day, I can be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. You know, but like most people, I'm usually some mixture of those things. Well, what usually happens? The show, the business deal, or the relationship or marriage isn't going my way. It doesn't seem to be coming off very well. And I begin to think that life, my partner, or she aren't treating me right. Now, my answer to this is to go get a bigger hammer, you know. My answer to this is to puff myself up twice normal size, get red in the face, and explain it to you one more time. I will talk very slowly so you can understand here. I know you're not too bright, so I will explain it to you very carefully. You know? I become, on the next occasion, still more demanding or gracious as the case may be. Well, I can tell you, I'm a chicken, so if I think I've got more power than you, I'm more demanding. And if I think you've got more power than I am, I'm more gracious. Now, still, this deal isn't suiting me. This play isn't suiting me. Now, you can get me to admit I might be somewhat at fault. I'm talking to myself. Well, yeah, I guess I could have been more diplomatic. You know, I could have been more diplomatic. But I'm really sure that other people are more to blame. You know, I could have been more diplomatic, but he's just completely unreasonable about this. He just said no without even discussing it with me. Imagine that. I become angry, indignant, and self-pitying. You know, what's my basic problem? Am I not really a self-seeker even when I'm trying to be kind? There's my inventory. Am I not a victim of the delusion from the inside out? I'm fooling myself. A victim of the delusion that I can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if only I manage well. You know, I think I can run my life and have it work out. If I believe that, I am delusional. And it isn't evident to my business partner, my wife, my girlfriend, any of these people, that these are the things that what I really want, and don't my actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? And here we go, folks. Am I not, even in my best, sober, junior guru moments, a producer of confusion rather than harmony? That's the best I can expect, sober, doing it my way. And I got quite a relationship with this material because I got one of these in my desk drawer, and I frequently, when I'm jammed up during the day, I got to pull this out and go through it. And every time, it's magic. I say, no wonder this isn't working. I can't get to the end of this without understanding why it isn't working. I start out, my vision is completely blocked out by all my good intentions. All I can see is that I just want everybody to be happy. I just want everybody to be successful. And I cannot understand why these people are trying to frustrate me, you know. They must be jealous of my genius or something like, you know. Why am I tormented by these little people, you know? And I get to... You know, before I get through this little piece, I've got the answer to that and why it's not working here. I used to make such a big deal out of the third step, and it's a big deal, but it isn't. The image that I came up with that works for me, and I tend to relate to these things in terms of images, is in Indianapolis, Roger Penske's the big Chevy dealer there. And when I'm home Monday, if I run up to Roger's dealership and I go in the showroom and I'll have a salesman start tagging me there, and I walk over and I take and I point to that red Corvette and I say, I want that red Corvette. I've made an important decision, and I've made an expensive decision, but I'm not driving a red Corvette. Before I get the keys to that car, I'm going to get to go in the back room with the finance manager and do a financial fourth and fifth step, right? And assuming that goes well, they give me the keys to the car. But guess what? If I don't make the payments, they come take it back. If I don't do steps 6, 7, 8, and 9, all of that good feeling that I got from doing this third step and turning my will and my life over to the care of God, just, you know, it just gets repoed. It goes away. And how many times?